So this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. And, you know, preparing for the Series 65, it honestly feels like trying to drink from a fire hose, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, it really is. But Cert Fuel actually makes it manageable, which is huge. They have this full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes that they figure out exactly where you're struggling. Plus, smart flashcards to hammer home the vocabulary and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. It's incredibly helpful, so check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth it.
All right, let's get right into it. You know, usually when we talk about like a professional diagnosis or a formal assessment, there's this comforting expectation of precision.
Right, like engineering.
Exactly, like engineering. If you fall off a ladder and break your arm, you go to the hospital, they take an x-ray, and there's that jagged white line on a glowing screen. The doctor just points at it and says, you know, there it is, broken.
It's incredibly binary. I mean, the bone is either intact or it's fractured. It's perfectly clear cut, which is honestly exactly what our brains crave. Yeah. We like things to be visible and quantifiable.
We want perfectly categorized boxes.
Yeah.
But then, and this is where it gets crazy, you step into the world of financial ethics, fiduciary obligations, and regulatory law, which is exactly the stuff you were studying for the Series 65 exam right now.
And suddenly that beautiful clear x-ray machine is completely smashed to pieces.
Literally broken. We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is, well, it's incredibly murky. It's muddy.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. And for someone preparing for this exam, you know, that murkiness can feel incredibly frustrating. You are looking for a simple yes or no answer, and the regulators just say,
well, it depends.
Exactly. It depends on the context.
Yeah, and that is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to deeply learn, retain, and most importantly, be able to seamlessly apply all these ethical practices and fiduciary obligations for your Series 65 exam.
And we really want to make this stick.
We are talking directly to you, the listener, because look, I have ADHD, and if you are someone who finds standard, dry textbook lectures completely unbearable, like if your brain just clicks off the second someone starts reading bullet points from a PowerPoint, we see you.
We completely understand that learning style.
Yeah, we are throwing the boring, monotonous lectures completely out the window today.
Because reading a textbook doesn't actually prepare you for the trick questions anyway. What's absolutely vital to understand here is that ethics makes up about 11% of your exam.
Which is what, like seven questions?
Roughly seven questions on the actual test, yeah. But more importantly, the ethical framework is the absolute foundation of literally everything else you're going to be tested on.
Right. It touches everything.
It does. This isn't just about memorizing a list of things you can't do. It's about understanding the underlying logic. We're going to explore exactly why these rules were written in the first place.
Because when you understand the why, you don't have to memorize.
Exactly. When you understand the history and the mechanical purpose of a regulation, you can outsmart the exam's trick questions without blindly memorizing anything.
So to accomplish that, we are introducing a cast of characters today. They're going to be joining us throughout this entire deep dive, and I want you to picture them in your head right now. These are the people who are going to lock this information into your long-term memory.
I love these characters.
Right. Okay, first up, we have Careless Carl. Carl is an investment advisor. He's not a malicious guy. He doesn't want to steal anyone's money, but his desk is covered in coffee-stained sticky notes. His filing cabinet is a total disaster.
He's legally sloppy.
Very sloppy. He means well, but he cuts administrative corners.
Basically, a compliance officer's absolute worst nightmare.
Precisely. Next, we have Anxious Annie. Now, Annie is Carl's ultra-wealthy, highly nervous client. She has massive generational wealth, but she trusts almost no one.
She questions absolutely everything.
Everything. She sends Carl panicked emails at 3 a.m. when the market dips, like 0.25%. She is generally terrified of losing her money.
And finally, we have Granny Gertrude.
Yes, sweet Gertrude.
Gertrude is a sweet 85-year-old client. She has a massive, very quiet portfolio. She bakes cookies for Carl's office. She doesn't really check her statements very often, but
there's always a but.
There is. Unfortunately, she recently acquired a new boyfriend named Lance. And Lance seems a little too interested in how she manages her bank accounts.
Ugh, Lance. We do not like Lance. So we've got Carl, Annie, and Gertrude. These three are going to help us visualize exactly how these dry, dense rules play out in the real messy world.
Let's set the foundation first.
Right, because before we can even talk about careless Carl accidentally losing anxious Annie's money, or Carl trying to protect Gertrude from Lance, we really have to establish what Carl's legal relationship to his clients actually is.
Which brings us to the absolute cornerstone of the industry, fiduciary duty.
So unpack that for us, because it sounds like a fancy lawyer word.
Fiduciary duty is not just a buzzword, I promise. It is the highest legal standard of care recognized in equity and law. The source material states that an investment advisor is a fiduciary with an affirmative duty of utmost good faith.
Utmost good faith.
Right, to act primarily for the benefit of its clients. And that duty is split into two massive pillars. You have the duty of care and the duty of loyalty.
Let's bring this to life, because those legal definitions can bounce right off the brain if you're not careful. I like to compare a fiduciary to a doctor.
That's a great analogy.
Right. A doctor is legally and ethically bound to prescribe the absolute best medicine for your specific biology, regardless of whether a pharmaceutical company offers them like a free trip to the Bahamas for pushing a different drug.
They cannot consider the trip.
Exactly. The doctor must put your health above their own financial incentive. Now, contrast that with the alternative standard in finance, which is the suitability standard. Suitability standard is, well, it's more like a used car salesman.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize the difference.
Yeah, because the car salesman can sell you a car that technically runs. It is technically suitable for driving to work. Even if it's, you know, not the best car on the lot.
Even if they're pushing that specific sedan on you just because the dealership is giving them a massive kickback to clear out inventory.
Right. They aren't breaking the law by selling it to you because it fits your basic need of a working vehicle.
Mm.
But they certainly aren't putting your best interest first.
And this distinction is the exact fault line the Series 65 exam absolutely loves to test. You have to separate the two roles in your head. Under the traditional rules, a broker-dealer and their agents owe a suitability obligation.
Okay, suitability for broker-dealer.
Right. Now, regulators have recently updated this with Regulation Best Interest, or REGBI.
Oh, yeah, REGBI.
REGBI forces broker-dealers to mitigate and disclose conflicts of interest at the time they make a recommendation.
Yeah.
They have to act in the best interest of the retail customer at that specific moment of the transaction. But, and this is crucial, it is still inherently a transactional relationship.
Right. So the broker-dealer sells you the stock, makes sure it was a good fit at that exact second, and then they can theoretically just walk away.
Exactly. They are done. But an investment advisor and an investment advisor representative like Careless Carl owes a continuous ongoing fiduciary duty.
It never stops.
It never stops. The duty of care means Carl has to thoroughly investigate and understand anxious Annie's risk tolerance, her tax situation, her long-term objectives. He has to give advice that is genuinely in her best interest every single day.
And the duty of loyalty.
That means Carl must place Annie's interests entirely ahead of his own. He has to fully and aggressively disclose any material conflicts of interest.
Okay, I have a direct question for you, the listener. If you are driving or, you know, walking the dog right now, I want you to think about this for a second before we give the answer.
Listen closely.
Well, let's say Careless Carl is an investment advisor representative,
right,
an IAR, and his golfing buddy Dave is an agent at a broker dealer who has the higher legal standard of care. I'll give you a beat to think about it.
You have it.
Okay. Who is it?
It is the IAR. Careless Carl has the higher legal standard.
Always.
Always. Investment advisors and their representatives are fiduciaries under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Broker-dealers traditionally owe that suitability or REGBI obligation, which, you know, just does not carry the same continuous overriding legal weight as a full fiduciary duty.
But here's where it gets really interesting, and I know this is a huge recurring trap on the exam.
Oh, the waiver trap.
Yes. Let's look at anxious Annie. Annie actually really likes Carl, but she is completely sick of all the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time they meet, Carl has to give her these massive disclosure brochures about conflicts of interest.
Pages and pages of it.
Right. So finally, Annie just throws her hands up and says, Carl, I trust you. I am paying you to handle this so I don't have to read 50 pages of legalese. I will sign whatever you want. Just draft up a waiver that says you don't have to be a fiduciary anymore. We'll skip the red tape and you just manage the money. Can she do that?
This is where the exam actively tries to get you. They try to trick you by making the client the one requesting the shortcut.
Because it sounds reasonable.
It sounds completely reasonable in the real world. But the answer is no. Absolutely, unequivocally not.
Never.
Never. Fiduciary duty cannot be waived by the client under any circumstances. It is fundamentally baked into the legal definition of the advisory relationship.
So even if the client is begging for it, it's illegal.
Yes. And to build on that, the reasoning goes back to the core philosophy of the SEC. The regulators operate under the assumption that retail investors simply do not fully comprehend the immense risk they are taking by relinquishing that protection.
They are saving Annie from herself.
Exactly. Careless Carl cannot slide a napkin across the table, have anxious Annie sign away her rights, and suddenly revert back to being a car salesman. If you are an investment advisor, you are a fiduciary. Full stop.
Period.
You cannot contract your way out of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Any contract provision attempting to waive compliance with any rule of the act is entirely void.
So if you are listening to this, lock that into your brain right now. You cannot waive fiduciary duty. Never.
Never, ever.
Okay, so we've established the legal bedrock. We know Carl must act in Annie's best interest. But what actually happens when Carl gets his hands on Annie's money? Let's talk about the mechanics of control.
We really need to deeply explore custody versus discretion.
Yes, because these two concepts sound incredibly similar to the average person on the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the regulatory world, they trigger completely different compliance nightmares.
Custody is a concept that trips up a massive percentage of test takers. When people hear the word custody, they usually picture a scene from a bank heist movie.
I picture a giant steel vault with gold bars.
Right, or physically holding onto paper stock certificates in a fireproof safe in the basement. But the source material and the regulators view it entirely differently.
So how do they define it?
Custody exists when an advisor directly or indirectly holds client funds or securities, or, and this is the kicker, simply has the authority to obtain possession of them.
Okay, let me test you again, listener. Listen closely to this scenario. We know Careless Carl is totally disorganized, right?
Sticky notes everywhere.
Everywhere. So he realizes that generating a physical invoice every month, mailing it to anxious Annie, waiting for her to panic, ask questions, write a check, and mail it back, it's just way too much of an administrative hassle.
It takes forever.
So Carl says to her, Annie, you trust me. It is infinitely easier for both of us if I just deduct my 1% advisory fee directly from your brokerage account every single quarter. Does Carl have custody? Think about it.
Take a second.
Okay, what's the verdict?
The answer is yes. Emphatically, yes. Deducting advisory fees directly from a client's account equates to having custody.
Hold on, I'm going to push back on this on behalf of the listener because that just does not track for a layman.
Let's hear it.
Carl isn't holding Annie's entire $1 million portfolio in his briefcase. He's just skimming his totally legal, pre-agreed upon 1% fee off the top to save postage and time. It's literally an automated billing process, like Netflix. Why on earth does the SEC consider that custody?
That is exactly the pushback the exam writers anticipate you having. And to understand it, you have to look at the regulatory philosophy of access.
Access.
Access. Custody isn't just about physical possession. It's about having a pipeline directly into the client's money. Think about the Bernie Madoff scandal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. The entire reason that fraud grew so massive was because there was no independent oversight of the actual assets. Madoff had total opaque control. Regulators are absolutely terrified of advisors who have a direct, unmonitored hose hooked up to a client's bank account.
Oh, I see. Because if you can take a little, you can take a lot.
Precisely. If Careless Carl has the systemic authority to tell the custodian to pull his fee out of anxious Annie's account, what is mechanically stopping him from pilling out slightly more than his fee?
That thing.
Exactly. Or pulling it out twice in 1 month because he's short on rent. The access itself is what creates the risk. The moment you can touch the money, you have custody.
Okay, that makes total sense when you put it like that. So let's clearly define the list for the listener.
Yeah, for it.
Custody means you have physical possession of the funds, or you have fee deduction powers, or you're acting as a trustee for a client's trust, or you have signatory power over a client's checking account, or you have full trading authorization, meaning you can sell stock and withdraw the cash.
Yes, that is custody.
Now, we have to contrast that with discretion.
Discretion is entirely different. Discretion is when you have a limited power of attorney. You can make trades within the account, you can buy and sell securities, but you absolutely cannot withdraw the cash and put it in your own pocket.
Let's use an analogy here to separate them in our heads. Custody is like you giving a valet the keys to your Ferrari, but the valet also owns the warehouse where they are parking it, and they have the title to the car in their desk. They have total control.
Scary level of control.
Exactly. But discretion is just regular valet parking. You give them the keys so they can drive the car and park it in the spot, but they can't sell the car and they can't drive it home. They just have the limited authority to move it around the lot.
That is a phenomenal analogy. Discretion is simply the authority to move the assets around within the account. And the exam provides a very specific framework for determining if an advisor is exercising discretion.
Yes, the three A's. This is a massive memory aid from the notes. Hmm. To know if Carl is exercising discretion, you look for the three A's: asset, action, and amount.
The three A's.
Right. If Anxious Annie is missing even one of those three A's in her instructions, Carl is exercising discretion to fill in the blank.
Let's break those down. Asset means which specific security is being traded. Action means whether we are buying or selling. Amount means exactly how many shares or what dollar amount.
Okay, so let's do a scenario. If Anxious Annie calls Carl in a total panic and says, "Carl, tech's exploding, buy some Apple stock right now," what is missing from her instruction?
Well, she gave the asset, which is Apple.
Yep.
She gave the action, which is buy.
Yep.
But she completely missed the amount. She just said some.
Right. So careless Carl has to sit at his messy desk and decide, well, does she mean 10 shares? 100 shares, $10,000 worth. Because Carl is making the decision on the amount, he is exercising discretion.
Let's try another one. Annie says, "Carl, the market looks shaky. Manage my 500 shares of Tesla as you think best." What did she miss?
Okay, she gave the asset, Tesla. She gave the amount, 500 shares, but she missed the action. She didn't say hold, she didn't say sell, she didn't say buy more. Because Carl has to make the choice to sell or hold, he needs discretionary authority.
Exactly.
But wait, if you're listening to this, you might logically assume that if Annie leaves anything up to Carl, it's discretion. But here is the loophole that traps almost everyone on the test. Time and price is not discretion.
This is perhaps one of the most frequently tested nuances of the rule. I cannot stress this enough.
If Annie calls Carl and says, "Carl, buy 1,000 shares of Microsoft when the price is right today." She gave the asset, Microsoft. The action, buy. The amount, 1,000 shares. All Carl is doing is watching the ticker tape, deciding on the exact time of day to push the execution button, or waiting for a specific dip in the price to accept it.
And according to the SEC, deciding time and price does not constitute discretion.
Wow.
Yeah. Carl does not need written discretionary authority to execute that order.
And why is that? Why the exception?
You have to understand the logic of why the regulators wrote the rule that way.
Yeah.
The market fluctuates by the millisecond. If an advisor had to get written permission just to wait an hour for a better price on a perfectly defined order, the market would just grind to a halt.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. The regulators grant this exception because the core parameters of the trade, the three A's, are already locked in by the client. But the exam loves to set another trap regarding discretion, specifically how it is granted.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Annie's too busy to specify anything. She just calls Carl and says, "Carl, tech stocks are taking a beating. Buy whatever tech stocks you think are best today. I trust you." She has just granted him oral or verbal discretion.
Which, knowing careless Carl, feels like a massive compliance red flag just taking it over the phone.
It is a massive risk. But there is a regulatory grace period built in, and you must memorize this exact timeline for the exam. For an investment advisor, if a client grants verbal discretion, the advisor has exactly 10 business days from the date of the first trade placed under that oral authority to get it formalized in writing.
10 business days, not 10 calendar days.
Business days.
Okay, so Carl executes the tech stock trade on Monday based on Annie's phone call. He now has 10 business days to get Anxious Annie to physically sign and return a limited power of attorney document. She drags her feet, and day 11 rolls around. Carl is officially in violation of the rules.
Exactly. And what makes this such a tricky exam question is the difference between entities. That 10 business day verbal rule applies strictly to investment advisors.
Wait, really? What about broker dealers?
If Dave, the broker dealer agent, gets that exact same phone call, he usually requires written discretion before the very first trade is ever placed.
Mm-hmm.
Zero grace period.
Why the discrepancy? Why does Carl get almost 2 weeks while Dave gets nothing?
It comes down to the nature of the relationship we discussed earlier. Broker dealers are engaged in rapid fire, transactional execution. There's no time for grace periods in a high frequency trading environment where the relationship might literally just be that single trade.
Right.
Investment advisors, however, are managing long-term holistic portfolios. The SEC recognizes that in an ongoing fiduciary relationship, freezing a dynamic portfolio just because a piece of paper is stuck in the mail harms the client. So they grant the 10-day administrative window.
Okay, that is fascinating. So let's pivot back to custody, because let's say careless Carl decides he really wants that power. He hates mailing invoices, so he decides to deduct his fees directly. We know he officially triggers all the custody rules. What is the ultimate price of holding that power?
It's high.
I assume it's an administrative nightmare that Carl has just unleashed upon his firm.
Oh, it is immense. The regulatory burden of having custody is huge. If you have custody, you must strictly adhere to four major requirements.
Run them down.
First, the assets cannot be held in Carl's personal safe. They must be held by a qualified custodian. Think of a highly regulated entity like a major bank, a registered broker-dealer, or a trust company.
Okay, qualified custodian.
Second, that qualified custodian must send detailed account statements directly to the client at least quarterly. Carl cannot be the middleman for the statements.
Why not?
Because that's exactly how frauds hide missing money. They doctor the statements.
Got it.
Third, the advisor must explicitly disclose that they maintain custody on their form ADV. And fourth, and this is the requirement, the exam writers are absolutely obsessed with the annual surprise examination.
Oh, the surprise exam. I love visualizing this one. Let's paint the picture for the listener. Careless Carl is sitting in his messy office. His feet are on the desk. He's playing solitaire on his computer. Suddenly, the door just kicks open.
Boom.
Standing there is an independent certified public accountant. They have a clipboard, a stern look, and they demand to verify and count every single penny of client assets across the entire firm right then and there.
And the crucial detail that makes it a true safeguard is that the CPA, not the advisor, chooses the irregular time of the exam.
It can't be scheduled.
It absolutely cannot be announced in advance. Careless Carl cannot be tipped off to clean up his books. And once this independent CPA completes the grueling surprise audit, the CPA, again, not the advisor, has exactly 120 days to file a specific form with the SEC.
Form ADVE.
Yes, Form ADVE.
And here's a mnemonic for you listening. ADV is the form you use for your standard registration, but ADVE, the E stands for examination. ADV examination. That is the form the accountant files 120 days after the surprise exam.
Perfect memory trick.
Yeah.
And beyond the operational headaches of surprise exams, having custody also triggers a massive financial requirement.
Oh, the net worth stuff.
Right. This raises a fundamental question about the financial stability of the advisor's firm itself. Regulators do not want broke, desperate advisors holding on to millions of dollars of client money.
Because desperation breeds theft.
Exactly. So the regulators enforce a financial scoreboard, a strict minimum net worth requirement for the firm.
Okay, lay the exact numbers on us. These are highly testable.
If your firm maintains custody of client funds, the minimum net worth requirement is $35,000.
Okay, 35 grand.
If your firm exercises discretion, but strictly does not have custody, that requirement drops to $10,000. And there's a third category. If you are an advisor who accepts prepaid advisory fees of more than $500, 6 or more months in advance, you are required to maintain a positive net worth.
Okay, I have to step in and push back here. Look at Anxious Annie. Annie has millions of dollars. Her portfolio is massive. Why on earth do the regulators care if Carl's firm only has 35 grand in the bank? The risk seems completely disproportionate to the amount of money being managed. Why $35,000?
I'm so glad you brought that up because this is a classic, classic exam trick. They will try to confuse you by mixing up the client's wealth with the advisor's wealth. The net worth requirement applies strictly to the advisor's firm, not the client.
So it doesn't matter if Annie has $50 million. It's Careless Carl's business entity that needs to prove it has a $35,000 net worth.
Exactly. A client's own net worth is never a factor in these specific minimum financial requirements for registration. The state regulators mandate this because they want to ensure that Carl's firm has enough financial padding to keep the lights on, pay the server bills, cover basic overhead.
Right, just to survive as a business.
If Carl's firm goes bankrupt and shuts its doors overnight, Anxious Annie's funds might get temporarily frozen or misplaced in the chaos of a liquidation. The $35,000 is a buffer to ensure the firm is a viable going concern.
So what happens if Carl is struggling? Let's say business is slow and Carl's firm operating account is getting dangerously low. He's looking at his firm's account and he's looking at Annie's massive cash account. He thinks, you know what? Dealing with all these different bank logins is exhausting. It's just easier. If I put all the money, my firm's money and Annie's money into one massive master account, I'm a wizard at Excel. I will just keep track of it on a spreadsheet so I know exactly whose money is whose.
Oh boy. What Carl is describing is called commingling, and it is strictly, severely prohibited by the NASA Statement of Policy on Dishonest or Unethical Business Practices.
Not allowed.
You absolutely cannot mix client assets with the firm's own proprietary assets.
Let's upgrade our Ferrari analogy here.
Oh.
Commingling is not just putting things in the same room. Commingling is like that valet parking your pristine Ferrari inside a massive, unmarked shared warehouse instead of your private locked garage.
Good track.
They haven't stolen the car. They fully intend to give it back to you. But by putting it in the general population with the warehouse's own vehicles, they have exposed your Ferrari to a massive risk. If the warehouse goes bankrupt and the bank forecloses, the bank might seize everything inside, including your Ferrari, because it wasn't legally separated.
That is exactly the systemic risk commingling creates.
Yeah.
The violation occurs the absolute second over. The funds mix in the same account. Commingling is illegal, even if no money is lost, even if no money is stolen, and even if Carl's Excel spreadsheet is 100% accurate.
Wow, even if it's accurate.
Internal accounting does not count. You need physical, legally separate accounts.
And what if Carl decides he's not just gonna park the Ferrari in the warehouse? What if he actually takes the Ferrari out for a joyride to Vegas? Or, in financial terms, what if he dips into Annie's funds to pay his office rent?
That is a completely different violation called conversion. Conversion is taking client assets and utilizing them for personal use. It's outright theft.
Embezzlement.
Jail time. Oh yeah. Conversion is obviously the more severe criminal violation. But it's vital for test takers to remember that commingling is independently prohibited. You don't have to steal the money to lose your license. You just have to mix it.
Okay, but wait. If mixing is illegal, how do massive brokerages handle millions of clients? Charles Schwab doesn't have 10 million physical steel vaults.
They utilize a system called street name registration.
Street name.
The securities are held in the brokerage firm's name for operational ease, to make buying and selling incredibly fast through the depository trust company. But the customer remains the actual beneficial owner.
So how do they avoid commingling?
To completely avoid commingling, those customer securities held in street name must be kept in segregated accounts.
Mm.
Mathematically and legally, completely separate from the firm's own proprietary trading accounts.
Got it. Street name is legal, efficient safekeeping, not commingling, as long as it is strictly segregated. Okay, we know how Carl manages the money and the brutal rules he has to follow to hold it. But how does Careless Carl actually make a living ethically? Let's talk about compensation.
Because investment advisors are held to a fiduciary standard, their compensation arrangements require incredible granular transparency. Absolutely, all compensation must be disclosed in writing before the advisory advice is rendered.
Makes sense.
Asset-based fees, which are a flat percentage of the total assets under management, are the industry standard. But the exam loves to dig into the controversial stuff. Specifically, performance fees.
Oh, performance fees. This is the good stuff. Generally speaking, performance fees are banned for investment advisors, right?
Correct.
And let's explain the psychology behind why. If Careless Carl says to Anxious Annie, listen, I won't charge you a flat fee. I only get paid if your portfolio goes up by 20% this year. If I hit that, I take a massive cut. Carl is now highly incentivized to take Annie's safe, stable retirement money, drive it to the metaphorical casino, and put it all on double zero roulette.
He's swinging for the fences.
Right. If he wins, he gets rich. If he loses, Annie loses her life savings, and Carl just shrugs and walks away to find another client. It creates an asymmetric risk profile that encourages dangerous gambling with client money.
That is the exact rationale the SEC uses. It aligns the advisor's greed with reckless behavior. But as with everything in regulation, there is a massive exception to this ban.
Of course there is.
It is called the qualified client exemption. The regulatory logic is that if a client is incredibly wealthy, they are assumed to be financially sophisticated enough to understand, negotiate, and absorb the massive risks associated with a performance fee.
All right, listener, pop quiz time. Think carefully about this scenario because it is a classic exam misdirection. Anxious Annie has a massive, beautiful mansion. It's fully paid off and appraised at $3 million.
Must be nice.
Right. She also has $1.5 million in other liquid assets, stocks, bonds, cash. To be considered a qualified client based on net worth, the rules require a net worth exceeding $2.2 million. Does Annie qualify to be charged a performance fee?
Think about the math.
Does she qualify?
No, she absolutely does not.
But she has over $4 million total.
And here is the mechanical reason why she fails. The net worth test strictly and explicitly excludes the value of the client's primary residence, as well as any mortgage tied to it.
Oh, the house doesn't count.
Exactly. So if we take her massive $3 million mansion out of the equation, her net worth for the purpose of this test is only her liquid assets, $1.5 million. She falls significantly short of the $2.2 million threshold.
That is such a sneaky trap. They put a huge number right at the front of the question to anchor your brain into thinking she's ultra rich, but you have to actively subtract the house.
They do it all the time.
So what is the other way she could qualify if her net worth isn't high enough?
The alternative pathway is the assets under management, or AUM, test. Hmm. To qualify this way, she must have at least $1.1 million in assets under management, strictly with this specific advisor.
Meaning she cannot have $800,000 managed by Carl and another $400,000 managed by a different firm across town. The $1.1 million has to be sitting directly under Careless Carl's management umbrella.
Correct. And if she does happen to qualify and they agree to a performance fee, the regulators still don't let Carl just run wild. The fee usually has to be structured as a fulcrum fee.
A fulcrum fee. Okay, picture a seesaw on a playground. The fulcrum is the exact pivot point in the middle.
Exactly. The fee structure must be perfectly symmetrical around a defined benchmark, like the S&P 500. Let's say the benchmark goes up 10% and Carl's portfolio goes up 15%. Carl outperformed, so his fee increases proportionally.
Okay, he gets his bonus.
But, and this is the core requirement, if the benchmark goes up 10% and Carl's portfolio only goes up 5%, his fee must decrease proportionally. Gains-only performance arrangements, where the advisor shares in the profits but takes no hit on the losses, are strictly prohibited.
He must share the pain of the downside if he wants to reap the reward of the upside.
Precisely.
Okay, let's talk about a completely different way Carl gets compensated. But this time, the money isn't coming from the client. Let's talk about soft dollars.
Oh, soft dollars.
I love this concept because, on the surface, it sounds incredibly shady. Let's say Careless Carl directs all of Anxious Annie's trades to one specific broker-dealer down the street. And in exchange for Carl sending them that massive volume of trading commissions, the broker-dealer buys Carl a diamond-encrusted iPad, pays the rent for his lavish downtown office space, and covers his first-class flights to a conference in Hawaii. That's totally cool, right?
No, absolutely not. You have just described a massive career-ending violation of the soft dollar safe harbor.
Okay, so let's back up. What exactly is a soft dollar, conceptually?
Think of it like a corporate airline loyalty program, but applied to finance. Instead of a broker-dealer giving an investment advisor a direct cash rebate for routing trades their way, which would be illegal, the broker pays for certain products or services that the advisor needs to run their business.
Okay, but that still sounds like a bribe.
It creates a massive inherent conflict of interest. The fear is that Careless Carl might choose to route trades to the broker that gives him the best personal perks, rather than routing trades to the broker that gives Anxious Annie the absolute best trade execution price.
Right. If the broker is paying for Carl's vacation, Carl doesn't care if Annie is paying 2 cents more per share on execution. He's compromised.
Exactly. So Congress, via Section 28 of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, created a safe harbor. This safe harbor explicitly defines what perks are okay to accept and what perks are illegal bribes.
And the philosophical dividing line is incredibly specific.
The rule asks, does the product or service provide lawful and appropriate assistance to the advisor in the performance of their investment decision-making responsibilities? Basically, does this perk tangibly help the client's portfolio, or does it strictly benefit the advisor's bottom line?
Okay, so let's run my absurd analogy through the safe harbor test. Paying Carl's office rent.
Not eligible. That is basic firm overhead. It helps Carl's wallet, not Annie's portfolio.
First class travel to a seminar.
Not eligible. Travel and entertainment are explicitly banned.
The diamond-encrusted iPad. Or, honestly, just regular, boring computer hardware. Say the broker buys Carl a brand new Dell desktop.
Not eligible. And this is highly tested. General-purpose computer hardware, even if it is used to analyze stocks, is explicitly excluded from the safe harbor.
Oh, wow. So what can Carl legally accept from the broker using soft dollars?
Research reports produced by analysts, specialized financial analysis software, portfolio analytics platforms, dedicated trading lines, or clearance and settlement services. Things that directly mathematically aid in making or executing investment decisions for the client.
The trick the exam uses here is fantastic, you have to remember. The proprietary software used to run a Monte Carlo retirement simulation qualifies for the safe harbor, but the actual physical computer monitor you use to look at the simulation does not.
Perfect distinction. And because accepting soft dollars is an inherent conflict of interest, it must be aggressively disclosed to the client in Form ADV Part 2A. Clients have a right to know if they are paying slightly higher trading commissions just so Carl can get free research software for his firm.
Which transitions us perfectly into our next major theme. We have covered how Carl gets paid by clients and how he gets compensated by brokers. But what happens when the flow of money reverses?
This gets dark.
Yeah. What if Carl is making payments to politicians? Or what if his clients are trying to funnel shady, untraceable cash into the financial system? We are moving into politics, dark money, and the concept of prudence.
Oh man, pay-to-play rules. This is fascinating.
This is when an investment advisor makes a campaign contribution to a local government official, secretly hoping to influence that official into awarding the advisor's firm a lucrative contract to manage a massive public pension fund.
It is a massive issue with a very dark history. Municipal bonds and state pension funds has historically been vulnerable to localized corruption. To combat this, both the SEC for investment advisors and the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board for municipal broker-dealers, have instituted draconian rules.
Draconian is the right word.
If you violate these pay-to-play rules, it triggers an automatic 2-year ban on receiving any compensation for advisory services from that specific government entity.
A 2-year ban on compensation basically means you lose the contract entirely. It is a death sentence for municipal business. Now, let's look at the side-by-side comparison, because the exam tests these specific dollar limits relentlessly. We need to compare the SEC rule for investment advisors versus the MSRB rule for municipal professionals.
Under the SEC rule for advisors, there is a very strict de minimis exception. You can contribute up to $350 per election to an official, but only if you are legally entitled to vote for them, meaning they are in your specific voting district.
Okay, $350 if you can vote for them.
Right. If you cannot vote for them, say they are running for governor of a neighboring state, the limit drops to $150 per election.
So $350 if you can vote, $150 if you cannot. But the MSRB rule for municipal finance professionals is much tighter, isn't it?
Significantly tighter, reflecting the history of municipal corruption. Under the MSRB rule, the limit is $250 per election if you can vote for them.
$250, okay.
But if you cannot vote for them, the limit is absolutely zero. Even a single $1 contribution to an out-of-district candidate triggers the devastating 2-year ban.
Wow. If careless Carl accidentally donates $5 to a mayoral candidate in the next county over because he liked their speech on TV, his firm is banned from managing that county's money for 2 full years.
Exactly. And remember, the limit is per election. The primary counts as one election, and the general counts as a second separate election.
Okay, let's pivot from political money to dark money. Anti-money laundering, or AML. The Bank Secrecy Act requires financial institutions to act as a frontline tripwire for criminal activity. And under recent rules, SEC-registered investment advisors are increasingly being treated as financial institutions for this exact purpose.
When it comes to AML on the exam, there are two primary reports you need to have memorized, the CTR and the SAR.
The Currency Transaction Report, the CTR. That gets filed for cash transactions exceeding $10,000. And we mean actual physical paper cash, not wires or checks.
Right. And then you have the SAR, the Suspicious Activity Report. That is filed for any suspicious transaction, regardless of cash, of $5,000 or more.
But here is the specific exam trap regarding AML, and it revolves around a concept called structuring.
Oh, smurfing.
Yeah, smurfing. Let me set up a scene to explain this. Anxious Annie is totally paranoid about the government tracking her movements. She has $19,000 in perfectly legal, tax-paid cash sitting in her safe that she wants to deposit into her brokerage account.
Perfectly legal money.
Right. But she knows about the $10,000 CTR reporting rule, and she absolutely hates the idea of the government getting a form with her name on it. So she goes to the bank and deposits $9,500 on Monday, and then she comes back the next day and deposits $9,500 on Tuesday. Just to stay slightly under the $10,000 radar.
Mm-hmm. Anxious Annie has just committed a federal crime.
Even though the money itself was 100% legal, she already paid taxes on it.
Yes. The Bank Secrecy Act makes the act of evasion illegal in itself. Deliberately breaking a large transaction into smaller sequential amounts, specifically to evade the CTR reporting threshold, is illegal. It is called structuring, or smurfing.
So the bank catches her.
Financial institutions use automated algorithms trained specifically to look for this exact pattern. And if they spot it, they will file a SAR on Anxious Annie, which triggers the exact government scrutiny she was trying to avoid.
Backfired completely. Okay, let's shift gears and look at a different kind of behavioral regulation. The Uniform Prudent Investor Act, or UPIA. This act governs exactly how fiduciaries should invest client money. And I want to push back on this concept of prudence because the history here is fascinating.
Let's see it.
Let's say Careless Carl takes a chunk of Annie's money and buys a highly speculative, incredibly volatile microcap penny stock. Is Carl instantly violating his fiduciary duty by buying an asset that is objectively dangerous?
If we were operating under the old rule, specifically the prudent man rule, originated from an 1830 court case called Harvard College v. Amory, the answer would be yes.
Oh, it goes back that far.
It does. Under the old system, every single investment was judged in complete isolation. A penny stock was deemed inherently speculative and therefore permanently forbidden for a fiduciary to buy. But under the modern Uniform Prudent Investor Act, the answer is no, not necessarily. This represents a massive philosophical shift in trust law that the exam tests constantly.
Explain that shift. How can a penny stock suddenly be considered prudent?
It's because the UPIA officially adopted modern portfolio theory. It introduced what is called the total portfolio rule.
Total portfolio?
Yes. You no longer evaluate an investment in a vacuum. You evaluate how it interacts within the context of the entire overarching portfolio. An incredibly risky asset, like that penny stock or an emerging market currency, might be perfectly prudent if it acts as a tiny, non-correlated hedge in an otherwise massive, boring, heavily diversified portfolio of government bonds.
Oh, wow.
The UPIA explicitly states that there are absolutely no categorical restrictions on any specific type of investment.
So you can't just look at one wild trade and scream imprudent. You have to look at the whole pie. If the pie is balanced, the wild ingredient might just be the perfect spice.
Exactly.
Okay, we are moving into the real danger zone, the thou shalt nots conflicts and code of ethics. Let's look at the absolute worst ethical violations Careless Carl could commit and how his firm's compliance department is supposed to catch him.
Let's start with a very simple one, borrowing money from clients.
Careless Carl has terrible personal finances. We know this. He is short on rent this month. He goes to Anxious Annie and asks if he can borrow $50,000. She's incredibly rich. She likes Carl, so she says yes. Can he take the loan?
Absolutely not. An investment advisor or an IAR cannot borrow money from a client unless that specific client falls into a very narrow exception.
What are the exceptions?
They must be a broker-dealer, an affiliate of the advisor, or a financial institution explicitly in the business of loaning funds, like a retail bank.
And Annie is just a wealthy individual. Now, what if Annie happens to work as a loan officer at a local bank? Can Carl borrow from her then?
No, because the loan is coming from Annie's personal brokerage account, not the bank's corporate lending department. So the loan is strictly banned. But here's the critical exam trap that trips up candidates who don't read the whole question.
Uh-oh.
What if Careless Carl was an agent of a broker-dealer instead of an IAR?
Oh, this is huge. If Dave, the agent of a broker-dealer, wants a loan, he can never borrow from a client, full stop. The regulators do not offer broker-dealer agents the same exceptions.
Correct.
There are no exceptions for banks, no exceptions for affiliates. Broker-dealer agents cannot borrow from clients, period.
That entity distinction is heavily, heavily tested. Now, let's talk about two concepts that candidates constantly confuse. Selling away versus personal trading.
Okay, let's unpack selling away first.
Selling away is when an advisor engages in securities transactions with a client or a third party outside the normal scope of their employing firm's business, completely off the books.
Give me an example.
Imagine Careless Carl has a buddy who is starting a private tech company. Carl secretly facilitates a deal to sell unregistered shares of that private company directly to Anxious Annie, without ever telling his compliance department. That is selling away, and it's a massive, fireable violation.
Let's use an analogy here. Selling away is like a bartender secretly selling their own homemade, unregulated moonshine out the back door to the bar's regular patrons.
Perfect analogy.
The bar owner is legally liable if someone gets sick, but the owner has absolutely no idea the transaction is even happening because it's not going through the cash register.
That perfectly illustrates the risk to the firm. But you have to contrast that moonshine operation with an advisor simply trading in their own personal brokerage account. Trading for yourself is not selling away. However, because access persons like Carl see client trades before the broader market does, personal trading carries a massive risk of a practice called front-running.
Front running. This is malicious.
Highly malicious.
This is when Carl looks at his system and sees that anxious Annie is about to place a massive order to buy 100,000 shares of a thinly traded small cap stock. Carl knows that an order that big is going to drive the stock's price up the second it hits the market.
So what does he do?
Carl quickly logs into his personal account, buys 1,000 shares for himself at the current low price, and then pushes Annie's massive trade through. Annie's trade artificially pumps the price up, and Carl immediately sells his personal shares into that artificial pump for a risk-free profit.
Which is blatant market manipulation and highly illegal. To prevent this, the Investment Advisors Act requires every registered investment advisor to adopt a strict written code of ethics. And a core component of this code is that access persons must regularly report their personal holdings and transactions to the chief compliance officer.
I am going to run through the exact numbers on this reporting schedule because repetition is key for passing this exam. If you are classified as an access person, you have to file an initial holdings report within 10 days of becoming an access person.
10 days.
And the data on that initial report must be current as of a date within the prior 45 days. So 10 days to file, 45 days current.
And you must file an updated annual report every 12 months, which also must be current within 45 days of the filing.
And finally, a quarterly transaction report showing every single trade you made, which must be filed within 30 days after the end of each calendar quarter. Plus, if Careless Carl wants to buy into an initial public offering, an IPO, or private placement limited offering, he cannot just do it.
He has to get explicit pre-clearance from his firm's compliance officer first.
What's fascinating about these rules is that they don't ban personal trading. They just force the conflicts out into the open where they can be monitored. Speaking of intense conflicts of interest, let's examine agency cross transactions.
Agency cross. This is an operational tightrope. This happens when Careless Carl represents both the buyer and the seller in the exact same transaction.
How does that even work?
He has one advisory client who desperately wants to sell a block of Apple stock, and he has another advisory client who wants to buy that exact same block of Apple stock. Instead of going to the open market, Carl just crosses the trade internally between the two accounts and collects a fee from both.
It creates a deeply divided legal loyalty. How can Carl fulfill his fiduciary duty to get the absolute highest price for the seller while simultaneously fulfilling his fiduciary duty to get the absolute lowest price for the buyer? Mathematically, he can't.
Because of that impossible conflict, the NASA model rule has six incredibly strict conditions that must be met to allow an agency cross transaction.
Let's run through them.
First, Carl needs prospective written consent from the clients in advance. Second, written disclosure of the exact conflict. Third, he has to send a detailed per-transaction confirmation. Fourth, he must provide an annual statement aggregating all cross-trades. Fifth, the client must have the right to revoke this consent on every single written disclosure and confirmation they receive.
That's a lot of paperwork. But the sixth condition is the one the exam traps you on. Careless Carl may not recommend the transaction to both parties. At least one side of the trade must have come to him completely unsolicited.
He cannot play puppet master on both sides of the fence to generate fees. One client has to ask for it independently.
All right, we are entering the final stretch, protecting the vulnerable and preparing for the worst. This is where we bring in Granny Gertrude.
Granny Gertrude is 85 years old. In the eyes of the law, this makes her an eligible adult under the NASA Model Act to protect vulnerable adults from financial exploitation. For your exam, the threshold for this protection is age 65 or older, or any adult over 18 with a mental or physical impairment that significantly affects their ability to protect their own financial interests.
And Careless Carl, despite all his administrative flaws, is actually a fiercely protective guy deep down. He notices that Gertrude's new boyfriend, Lance, is suddenly sitting in on their meetings.
Red flag.
Lance is answering questions for her, isolating her, and most alarmingly, Lance is requesting massive, unprecedented wire transfers out of Gertrude's account to offshore banks. Carl strongly suspects elder financial exploitation is happening right in front of him.
This is a heavy, real-world situation that advisors face, and the regulatory rules are very specific about who Carl must report this to and who he may report this to.
Direct question to you, the listener. Carl suspects Granny Gertrude is being robbed by Lance. Who are the mandatory reports, and who is the permissive report? Take a second.
Got your answer.
Okay, tell us.
Reporting the suspicion to Adult Protective Services, APS, and the State Securities Administrator is absolutely mandatory. Carl must notify them promptly. But notifying Granny Gertrude's pre-designated trusted contact, the person she listed on her account opening form, is permissive. He is allowed to notify them, but not required by law.
But here is the crucial, critical exam trap. What if the trusted contact on file, I as Lance, what if Lance made her list him as the contact?
If the firm suspects the trusted contact is the one actually perpetrating the exploitation, they must never notify them.
That makes total logical sense. You don't call the bank robber to tell them the police are coming. But reporting it doesn't stop the wire transfer. What can Carl actually do to stop the money from leaving the account today?
Under the Model Act, the firm may place a temporary hold or delay disbursements of funds for up to 15 business days.
15 business days. Again, not calendar days. That is 3 weeks of real time for APS and the state to investigate the offshore wire. And when Carl delays that disbursement, the firm has to notify all authorized parties on the account within 2 business days. Except, again, the suspected exploiter. Even if Lance managed to make himself a joint account holder, you do not tell him you froze the money.
And if Carl follows all these steps, the Model Act grants him immunity from civil and administrative liability. If Gertrude gets mad that her money was frozen, she can't sue him. But that safe harbor has a strict 2-prong test. He's only immune if he acts in good faith AD with reasonable care. If he acts recklessly or freezes accounts out of malice, he loses the immunity entirely.
Let's quickly shift from protecting Gertrude's physical money to protecting her digital identity. Reg SP, the privacy rule, under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act.
This rule requires financial institutions to provide a clear privacy notice describing exactly how they collect and share a client's non-public personal information. And crucially, it requires an opt-out mechanism for sharing that data with non-affiliated third parties, like marketing firms.
If you are taking notes, underline this. It is an opt-out mechanism, not opt-in. You don't need the client's affirmative permission to share their data, but you must give them a reasonable, crystal-clear chance to say, please do not share my data. If they ignore the notice, you can share it.
Finally, we need to address the morbid but necessary reality of business. What happens if careless Carl, who runs his firm completely alone, steps off a curb and gets hit by a bus? This is covered by the Business Continuity and Succession Plan, or BCP.
Advisors are required to have a written plan for data backup, disaster recovery, and succession planning. It's not enough to just hope for the best.
And the exam trap here relates specifically to sole practitioners like Carl. If Carl is incapacitated or dies, anxious Annie and Granny Gertrude are suddenly locked out of their life savings because no one else has legal authority over the firm. Regulators specifically test your awareness that succession planning for a sole practitioner is a strict regulatory requirement, not just a good business idea. Your fiduciary duty extends to ensuring your clients are protected even after you can no longer physically serve them.
Wow, okay, I am ringing my imaginary bell. Ding, ding, ding. All right, pens down, take a breath. We are going into the lightning round recap. We are going to rapid fire the absolute biggest, most testable takeaways from this entire deep dive.
Let's hit it. Fiduciary duty versus suitability.
Yeah.
IRs are fiduciaries. It is the highest legal standard of care. It requires continuous monitoring, and it absolutely cannot be waived by the client under any circumstances. Broker-dealers traditionally owe a transactional suitability or Reg BI best interest obligation.
Custody versus discretion. Custody means access. Deducting your fees directly is custody. It requires a $35,000 net worth for the firm and a 120-day surprise exam, resulting in form ADVE. Discretion is simply trading without the client specifying the asset, action, or amount. Time and price is not discretion. And for an IA, you have 10 business days to get verbal discretion formalized in writing.
Commingling is parking the client's Ferrari in the firm's shared warehouse. Conversion is stealing the Ferrari for a joyride. Both are completely illegal.
Soft dollars. The safe harbor allows research reports and portfolio software. It explicitly bans office rent, general purpose computer hardware, and travel.
Pay-to-play rules. For the SEC, it's $350 if you can vote for the candidate, $150 if you can't. For the MSRB, it's $250 if you can vote, and absolutely zero if you cannot. Violations trigger a 2-year ban on business.
Structuring is breaking up perfectly legal cash deposits to avoid the $10,000 CTR reporting threshold. The act of evading the report is a federal crime.
And for protecting vulnerable adults, firms can place a 15 business day hold on suspicious disbursements. You have mandatory reporting to the state and APS, and you absolutely never notify the suspected exploiter, even if they are the trusted contact.
Boom! That is an incredible amount of dense regulatory information. But if you understand the why behind the rules, the access, the conflicts of interest, the history of corruption, you won't have to blindly memorize every single sentence. You can just logically deduce the answer on exam day.
Before we go, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought that builds on everything we've discussed today about ethics. As we move rapidly into a technological era where artificial intelligence algorithms are beginning to generate personalized investment advice and execute millions of trades automatically in milliseconds, who exactly holds the fiduciary duty? Is it the advisory firm that deployed the bot? Is it the software programmer who wrote the underlying code? Or is it the AI itself? If an AI hallucinates, learns a toxic trading pattern, and front-runs a market to benefit its own internal learning metrics, how do you mathematically apply a 1940s ethical legal standard to a neural network? Think deeply about that as you study.
That is heavy. The diagnostic money waters are only going to get murkier, my friends. We are stepping away from the clean, simple x-ray and walking straight into the fog of the future. Good luck on your Theory 65 exam. You are going to absolutely crush it. Thanks for taking the deep dive with us.